From NPR in Salt Lake City, I'm Ira Flatow with Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. Millions of years ago, giants roamed the earth, many of them right here in Utah. Coming up live from Salt Lake, a look at some of the state's paleontological treasures. Utah's one of the best places to be if you're into the ancient world. From massive long-necked sauropods to a tiny prehistoric reptile with a twisty clawed tail to the Utah Raptor. No, this is not a sports team. Plus, learning about Mars from studying Utah's desert. We'll talk about what we can learn about the geology of the Red Planet by looking at our own rocks, and how a group is using Utah as a practice site for people one day living and working on Mars. Sci-Fi Live in Salt Lake City after this break. Stay with us. If you're into old stuff, Utah is a great place to be. And I don't mean antiques roadshow vintage kind of stuff. I mean really old stuff. Think Jurassic Park and older. The climate and geology of Utah make this state a fantastic finding fossils place. That's for some of the old favorite dinosaurs you recall from your childhood picture books, you know, to plenty of new species found in Utah for the first time. And remember, there's more out there than just dinosaurs. Fossil remains of other plants and animals are helping paint a better picture of what life was like on our planet millions of years ago. We're coming to you from Salt Lake City today as the guests of KUER, broadcasting from the Grand Theater at Salt Lake Community College, and we're here to talk paleontology. And if you're here in the audience, please feel free to step up to the microphones. We've got one here, one there. We have one up in the balcony. Good to see the folks in the balcony up there. Yeah. If you want more information, you know, always go to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guest right to left on your radio. Brooks Britt is an associate professor in the Department of Geological Sciences at Brigham Young University, just down the road a piece in Provo. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Brian Sweetek is a science writer. His new book, My Beloved Brontosaurus, On the Road with Old Bones, New Science, and Our Favorite Dinosaurs, just out. Welcome to Science Friday.
I'm glad to be here.
Randall Ermus is the curator of paleontology at the Utah Natural History Museum. We had a great tour of that museum, and I tell you, go over there and take a look if you haven't been there. It's new and it's wonderful. He's also an assistant professor in the Department of Geology and Geophysics at the University of Utah here in Salt Lake. Welcome to Thanks. Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Let me ask you first, you write in your book, Brian, that I came to Utah just for the dinosaurs. Is that really why you came to Utah?
It's absolutely true.
Tell us why. What you mean, why you did that.
Well, the year before I moved here in May of 2011, there are 8 new species of dinosaurs just named from Utah alone, and there are more sort of in progress and press. There are ones out in the field that we haven't found yet. Really, it's a dinosaur gold mine.
Really? 8 new ones?
Yes, just in 1 year alone.
Randall, tell us about what those new ones are.
There are a host of different ones. We have one sitting between us here, looming large, Utah Ceratops with the eponymous
state fossil.
That's
this one to my left right here?
Yeah, right here. It's a new horned dinosaur from 75 million years ago in southern Utah.
Wow. Well, and it's found in no other place?
No other place. And the only fossils are right here in Salt Lake City.
Is it, you know, it's got one horn on it? Is that correct? Is it, like, related to Triceratops, the one we've seen?
Yeah, it's a relative of Triceratops and other horned dinosaurs. It's got a small horn over its nose and 2 horns over its eyes, and then it's got a big frill with various spikes and knobs coming off of it.
Mm-hmm. And we have another skull over here to my right. Which one is that one?
That's Allosaurus, Utah's state fossil.
Did you all know this was a state fossil? No. That's a state fossil.
The state fossil.
Well, I don't think many states have a state fossil. They have a bird, a plant.
More than you'd suspect.
Yeah. Well, and the state birds count as state dinosaurs as well.
That's right. A bird is a dinosaur. So it's sort of 2-for-1 in the state. Now, what makes Utah so great for dinosaurs? Why so many dinosaurs and new dinosaurs? I mean, anybody, I'll throw that open.
It's our geology. It's the same reason we have 5 national parks, 7 national monuments. We're part of the Colorado Plateau, tremendous uplift, this upheaval, and then erosion, exposing things were buried kilometers below the surface, are exposed at the surface now. And unlike places like New Jersey or New York, which are covered with verdant landscapes of trees and grasses, Utah is pretty barren. And so you, as you walk along, you can see the bones coming out of the ground.
Now, I asked somebody last night about this. I said, can you actually go out in your backyard or on a roadside and kick up a dinosaur fossil? I said, yeah. Absolutely. Have you all done that? Anybody discovered fossils? Yeah, they have. You can do that here.
Just have to know where to look.
Where is the best place to look? Where is the best place in the state to look?
It's wherever the right age strata are exposed. Randy works in, right now, a lot of Triassic rocks. I'm working in early Cretaceous rocks. You get out the geologic map, you learn where the exposures are, and you load up your rigs, and off you go.
Wow.
And if you want to find fossils from 500 million years ago to the present, you can pretty much find a rock layer in Utah that has them. So.
Huh. What is different than what we know about dinosaurs? I've mentioned we all grew up with dinosaurs. Brian, you talked about specifically the old Brontosaurus, the poor Brontosaurus, what it's gone through over the last few decades. What happened to it?
Well, it's a ghost. It's been dead for over a century, really, scientifically. It was turned out to be a synonym of another one of these long-necked, heavy-bodied dinosaurs called the Apatosaurus. That was figured out in 1903. But for whatever reason, it kind of stayed on the books. It stayed in museum exhibits. And it became the epitome of dinosaurness. It was my entree to dinosaurs as a kid. And it was just at that time that they finally found the head. And they fixed the head problem. They used that to sort of spur this new image of a more active animal, more dynamic yeah. animal. But we can't let it go. It's still this yeah. kind of ghost of a dinosaur that hangs around museum halls.
Yeah, I remember. And you write about it in your book. When they replaced the head, the famous Brontosaurus at the American Museum of Natural History. You grew up there in that museum, right?
Well, not in the museum, but nearby. I'm not ready to be committed to collections just yet.
You will be more valuable when you are.
Oh, absolutely.
We can find a place for you, Brian.
Oh, sure. Thank you, Randy. I look forward to it.
But that was like a seminal event when everybody growing up saying they're taking the old head off and putting in... Does that mean there was no such thing as a Brontosaurus? It was always... Misnamed and miscalculated?
Well, the bones are real. The animal's real. If you go to the Yale Peabody Museum in New Haven, Connecticut, you can see the actual bones that Othniel Charles Marsh used to name Brontosaurus, but the image of what a Brontosaurus was, this slow, stupid, plodding animal that sort of just bathed in swamps all day and didn't do anything else except eat and make little dinosaurs, that image is, basically, it's gone entirely now. Mm. But to me, it's an excellent baseline to gauge how our knowledge of dinosaurs has changed since Brontosaurus was named.
If you have any questions in the audience, you'd like to step up to the microphone. The mics are out there, and don't be the last one up there because you will never get your question in if you're the last one. I encourage you to do that. Let's talk, Randy, a little bit about what are some of the big misconceptions you see people have about paleontology? What do they think it is, and what is it really?
That we dig up humans. That's a big
one. They think
one.
You dig up humans.
Oh, yeah, and human, pots and stuff like that.
Do people, I remember reading a survey that 41% of Americans think that the Flintstones were real.
Yeah.
No, that maybe not that cartoon character, but that people did live at the same time dinosaurs did. 41%.
Yeah, yeah. It's not uncommon. But, it's because we're talking about such a vast amount of time that it's hard to conceive, I think. And so what a few thousand years ago is just as hard to conceive as 100 million years ago.
So they were separated by hundreds of millions of years. Right.
65, or a little bit less. Yeah.
That was the extinction of the last dinosaur was about 65.
Yeah.
And that big asteroid came in and
the coup de grace.
They were on their way out.
Well, it's under debate, but a lot of people think there were other things going on, like big volcanic eruptions that were having effect before the asteroid hit.
Mm-hmm. And of course, as you mentioned on some of your other shows, their descendants are still here among us, the birds, the most speciose group of vertebrates on land today.
Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. Before I go to the question in the audience, Brian, let me ask you this question. I sort of ask it delicately about T-Rex and marital relations, how should I put it that way? that people are trying to figure out why T-Rex had such short, little, bony forearms,
yeah.
right? What
yeah.
would you do with that? But they came up with some interesting ideas.
Well, yeah, in the original papers, Henry Fairfield Osborne, who had named Tyrannosaurus Rex, he couldn't figure out why this massive sort of deep-skulled, knife-toothed dinosaur would have such puny-looking arms, so he figured that maybe, you know, during mating, the male sort of stroked or cuddled the female with these little arms. But I'll tell you, we really shouldn't laugh at Tyrannosaurus Rex. You couldn't beat an arm wrestling contest with this dinosaur if you tried. Each arm could curl about 400 pounds apiece. If there's any dinosaur that deserves ridicule for this, it's one from South America called Carnotaurus that had arms that might have not even stuck outside of its body cavity and could pinwheel them around, but that's about it. So even Tyrannosaurus Rex would laugh at this other dinosaur.
All right. Well, I can't follow that up, so let's go to the audience. Let's go over to this gentleman right here. Yes, sir. First question before the break.
Thank you. Are there any ground-penetrating radars or anything that tell you how to find these things, or do you just wander around in the desert and stumble across them?
They'll never admit they wander around.
It only works in movies, to be honest. Yeah. You can find mammoths or mastodons where you have some difference in the density between the bones and the substrate, but with dinosaurs, it's never worked. So it's disappointing, I know. It makes for spectacular footage, but it doesn't work because the bones and the rock typically are the same density. So here's the trick. We're always digging blind. You might see something on the surface, but you have no idea what you're going to find below the surface.
What is it about the history of this area that makes a great place for where the dinosaurs were living?
Well, dinosaurs lived on land. They didn't live in the ocean. Except for birds, they didn't live in the air. And so you want to find sediment rocks that are composed of sediments that were deposited on land, so rivers, streams, lakes. And we had a lot of that through our geologic history during the Age of Dinosaurs.
And there was a giant inland sea, right?
That's right.
Stretched from where to where?
From the Arctic all the way to the Gulf of Mexico, called the Western Interior Seaway, but from about 90 million to 70 million years ago.
Yeah, so Utah used to be shorefront property during the Cretaceous.
Yeah. Property values were sky high.
Wow.
The mosquitoes would have been pretty bad, though.
I'll bet you. Do we have time? I think we have time for a question. Well, we have a quick question here from the audience right before the break.
Triceratops is my favorite dinosaur, and I've been reading how there's now some dispute about maybe some of them are actually immature versions of another one, and I was wondering how much dispute is there over classification?
There's quite a bit. I mean, I'll tell you this right now. Triceratops is safe. You don't have to worry. You can sleep soundly tonight. Triceratops is not going anywhere. It's two other dinosaurs called Torosaurus and Natoceratops that are found in the same deposits that seem like they're more mature versions of the same animal. So do we have one dinosaur or do we have three? And this is something that's very common in paleontology. I mean, we're just working off anatomy most of the time. And you might find an infant, you might find an adult, and name them as two different species. But when you find those intermediate growth stages, it all comes together. So paleontology is constantly reshuffling the number of dinosaur species that we think we've got.
All right, thanks for that. Great question. We're going to come back. We'll take a lot of questions. I see people are at all the microphones. We'll come back with Randy Ermus and Brian Sweetek and also Brooke Spritt. And stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're in Salt Lake City talking about Utah paleontology, coming to you from the beautiful Grand Theater on the campus of Salt Lake Community College. My guests are Randall Ermus, Brooke Spritt, and Brian Sweetek. And we'll go right to the audience. Let's step up to the mic there.
Can I have two questions?
Can he have two questions? Yeah. Okay. I'm just democratic about this. Go ahead. Sure.
The first one is, so when I go to Moab, why do I never see bones, but I only see footprints?
When you go to Moab, you only see footprints, not bones.
It's famous for both bones and footprints, actually. There are a number of dinosaur quarries. We have a crew down there excavating north of Moab right now. So you just don't, their bones erode so rapidly, you don't see them on the surface very often. But those footprints at the right horizons, you'll find those quite a number of places down there, in Triassic, Jurassic, and even in Cretaceous strata in that area.
And you had the second one, bonus question?
How old are Allosauruses?
150 million years old, give or take a few.
You know what an Allosaurus is?
Yeah.
What is it?
They're...
Get up to the mic, please.
They're like raptors that Sanford, Utah.
Hey, Randy?
Yeah, they're large carnivorous dinosaurs, like the skull that we have sitting in front of us here. Some of them got up to almost Tyrannosaurus Rex size, not quite. And I could answer your question a different way. We know that they got to about 20 years old before they died.
That's how long they lived.
That's how long they lived. Yeah.
Good questions. Thank you. Let's go way up into the balcony up there at the top. Yes.
Hi, Ira. It's great to be here. It's awesome seeing you. My question is, over the 75 million to 150 million years ago, what happened geologically to make Utah a good place for dinosaurs? Was it, did our climate change, or where was Utah in the whole Pangea thing? Where do we fit into this?
Yeah. Anybody want to? That, Brian, you want, Randy?
Oh, okay. Utah was in North America, of course, still at that time, and the continents were already splitting apart 150 million years ago, and starting to move northward a little bit, but there were no ice caps at either poles, and it was a hothouse world, as we call it. So it was pretty nice climate. Would have been warm, very warm during the summer, and because the mountains had just started building in sort of Nevada and western Utah, that caused that part of the land to go up, and then the land in eastern Utah and Colorado to go down, and that's why we got part of the reason we got the seaway there.
So you wouldn't see the mountains we see now then.
Yeah, but there would have been smaller mountains towards the west.
And one of the other factors that made Utah great for dinosaurs is because there's this sort of barrier that hasn't been found yet, that isolated dinosaurs north and south about 75 million years ago. I mean, Utah Ceratops on the stage here is a great example of that, of unique dinosaurs that seem to only exist in southern Utah or in the southern sort of range. So it's almost like islands on continents. So you have this shoreline, bayou-like environment where you're having dinosaurs evolve in Utah that aren't seen anywhere else.
Very interesting.
One more factor was it's a basin. We don't have any record of dinosaurs that lived in mountains because the paleo mountains have eroded away. But you have records of dinosaurs that lived in areas that were actively being downwarped and filled with sediments, what we call a basin. So the mountains that were off to the west of us here now provided sediment to fill in this basin, and the volcanoes off in that region as well, farther to the west and up to the north, settled into these areas and preserved. So you need to have a basin that's where the crust is downwarping.
That's our hashtag for today. For today, downwarp. We're going to hashtag that one so everybody will know that.
Thank you.
Yes.
So as a kid, my favorite dinosaur was the Velociraptor. And then recently I found out that basically everything I know about that dinosaur is a lie. So I was wondering what the differences are between my conception and, you know, with help of Steven Spielberg's Velociraptor and the actual creature.
Yeah, that's the odd thing. Velociraptor in Jurassic Park wasn't really Velociraptor. It was actually Deinonychus, this other sort of larger predatory sickle-clawed dinosaur. The name got changed because Michael Crichton wrote a book that lumped the dinosaurs together in a weird way. And that's, and, you know, really, if you're going to make a Hollywood movie, you know, saying, like, you bred raptors, is a lot more sort of dramatic than going, you bred Nikuses, I guess. It's just sort of a little more uncomfortable.
Yes.
But, yeah, feathers is the main thing. I mean, Velociraptor and all these dinosaurs in this Deinonychosaur group were very feathery. They're very avian. So they weren't sort of the scabrous, scaly, monstrous animals that you saw in Jurassic Park. And the main thing, if you ever do an impression of a Velociraptor, you know, people mostly put their wrists down with their palms facing down, right? But dinosaurs weren't slappers. They were clappers, so hands together. So if you take anything away from this today, just remember, dinosaurs are clappers and not slappers.
There you go. I'm feeling smarter already. How about the skin, Randy? At the museum, you were showing me some actual dinosaur skin, fossilized skin. It was kind of interesting.
The preservation in southern Utah, we're working in Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. These are rocks that are about 75 million years old. It's truly amazing. We find duckbill dinosaur skeletons, and they're one of the most common dinosaurs, but usually dinosaur skin impressions are incredibly rare. In this case, about 60% of the skeletons we find have skin impressions of some sort, and some of them are covering entire portions of the tail or the body. And I've got actually a lower jaw of a duckbill dinosaur right here in front of me, and Ira, you might be able to see these white marks here.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are where a giant crocodile bit the head of this duckbilled dinosaur 75 million years ago.
And we have, it must have hurt.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and so, wow. And so that's how you find them together, and that's how you know who feeds on what. And...
In this case, we didn't find the crocodile, but it turns out that carnivorous dinosaurs make slightly different bite marks than crocodiles versus mammals, and so we can tell based on the shape of the marks who made them.
That's terrific. Let's go down here. Yes, sir.
What is the average lifespan of a Utah raptor?
I happen to have a femur of Utah raptor here in front of me. It's a little over 0.5 meter long. And by cutting through these bones and looking at the different layers, they call lines of arrested growth, which is just a fancy way of saying growth lines, just like on tree rings. We can tell the oldest one we have, and we have 9 individuals of these, reached the age of 17 years. That's a great question. I like that.
Now, while you hold the bones up, we have another big bone that's in the front here. What bone is that one?
That's a cast of the femur of Apatosaurus, the so-called brontosaur that he was talking about. And so that's about as tall as I am. It's just about 6 feet tall.
You know, when I talked to the dinosaur experts years ago about dinosaurs being birds, they said, go to the museum and bring a chicken wing with you or bring a chicken leg and hold it up to the bone that you see. They'll look identical. Almost identical kind of bone and shape. That's what, one of the reasons why we think they're related.
Absolutely. When I was working on Tyrannosaurus a number of years ago, I'd have a little pigeon skeleton on the mount on the desk, and then I'd have the Tyrannosaur bones scattered around me. And if there was an articulation you couldn't understand, you could go look at the bird and largely figure that out.
You won't see it at every museum, but if you go to up-to-date museums, you know where to look. You can actually see dinosaur wishbones as well. If you look at the chest of Tyrannosaurus rex, if it's really up-to-date, you'll see the Tyrannosaur wishbone on there. I mean, I wouldn't want to try and take one of these things down and then break it for good luck, but, you know, it's still there.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. Okay, let's go over here now.
Yeah, I got a question, but I want to tell you a quick little funny story about the Brontosaurus, Apatosaurus. My daughter was 3 years old, and she was in preschool, and they went to the post office for a field trip, and when they went there, it was just as all the dinosaur stamps had come out, and the postman there was telling, oh, here's Tyrannosaurus, Triceratops, and oh, here's Brontosaurus, and my daughter goes, no, that is an Apatosaurus. They put the wrong head on it. So the postman looks over at the teacher, and she goes, I don't know.
Where did that come from?
Kids are on
that's
the ball.
That's a great story. Do you have a question?
But the question is at, you know, we know the asteroid came in and basically ended the reign of the Cretaceous, but there are species of the dinosaurs seem so different between the Triassic, the Jurassic, and the Cretaceous. Was there some other extinction event in between those too?
There are a number of different extinction events, and you know, we think about the age of dinosaurs as a single monolithic thing, but if you think about a timeline, Tyrannosaurus rex being 65 million years old and the first dinosaur being 230 million years old, Tyrannosaurus rex is actually closer in time to us than it is to the first dinosaur. So there's a lot of change that happens in the middle there. And one of the reasons dinosaurs became so successful is a mass extinction event at the end of the Triassic at 201.5 million years ago.
So did they go from being small up to the largest ones at the end?
They did increase in size. Most of the Triassic dinosaurs are pretty small. There's a few that got larger, but they were just one of many reptiles at the time, and it took an extinction event to clear out the ecosystems for them to become successful.
And the extinction event allowed mammals then to flourish? To develop?
In part, that's the one at the end of the Cretaceous did, yeah.
Yeah. Terrific. Yes, step up to the mic.
I'm wondering, I know we have some general ideas about like the musculature of the dinosaurs by like muscle scars, I think they're called. But I'm wondering, how much do we have to infer about their behavior and their physiology?
Yeah.
Because a lot of it just does not, you know, fossilize. And how much is? I'm basically wondering if there's a kind of a limit to what we can figure out about these animals without using analogs to modern day.
Yeah, so we have to guess a lot.
Modern animals are the way we figure out a lot of these things. Where the muscle scars all are, all tetrapods have the same series of bones, basically, and you can look for the muscle scars. Though muscles vary from one group to another, but we also use things called phylogenetic bracketing, where we look at, okay, we say here are dinosaurs, here are the birds are their descendants, so we get insights from them. And then on the other side, we can look at some of their distant relatives, such as crocodilians, which are archosaurs, and we look at their lung structure, and we learned that they just recently learned here at the University of Utah that the archosaurs, the crocodilians, actually have a single
a unique lung that allows the air to flow only in one direction through it, just like a radiator of a car. The gases pass only one way. So we can learn a lot by looking at the present. Likewise, we can learn a lot about the present by looking at the past.
But how much can we tell about what the color of the skin or what it looked like? Is that preserved at all, the color?
Well, for feathered dinosaurs, it is. I mean, that's been one of the things I heard as a kid all the time, is that we'll never, ever know what color dinosaurs were. And I used to, you know, draw these really garishly colored, awful, awful dinosaurs with purple and fire engine red and everything else. They're actually colored a lot more like ravens and magpies that you might just see right outside. The way that this is done is through microstructures that are within feathers. And these are modern bird feathers as well, called melanosomes. Mm-hmm. And they help create colors like black and brown and red and rust, colors like that. So there's a structural basis for color in these feathers. By looking for those same structures in fossilized dinosaur feathers, paleontologists can sort of reverse engineer what colors they were. So they've only done this for a few so far, but the little feathered dinosaurs that they've been able to accomplish this with wouldn't look all that much different from the raven that you might see on the side of a highway.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to the audience question right there. Yes, go ahead.
How deep do you usually have to dig to find bones?
Well, we start out on the surface because that's where we can actually find the bones coming out of the rock, but sometimes we have to dig really, really deep depending on the angle of the layers and stuff. I've seen, we've had a few digs where we had to remove something like 20 feet of rock from above the layer where the bones were.
Wow. Let's go up there to the balcony. You got a question up there in the balcony.
I was just wondering, what was the most amazing find you or one of your colleagues has found in Utah, and why, I guess?
He wants my job, this kid. That's a great question. That's a great... Who wants to answer that?
Well, I'll jump in first because I haven't really found anything. I found a little lizard track in a Dinosaur National Monument in the Triassic Rock, and I brought it to Randy because I was out with his crew, and he said, where's the rest of it? So I'm still working on it, and I will try not to disappoint you this summer. Well,
all right, let me remind everybody that this is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Plato here with Randall Ermes, Brooks Britt, and Brian Sweetek. All right, the other two, what would be your key find, the one you like the most?
It's usually whatever you're working on currently, and one that we're working on now, it's not even a dinosaur, it's what we call a drapanosaur. These are crazy-looking little things that look like they're designed by some type of committee, and it has a head of a bird, it has the arms of a and shoulders of a mole, it... has an elongate neck that we think may have been a fold itself up like a Z, and the tail was elongate and prehensile. It could wrap around branches, what have you, and it had a claw at the end of the tail.
Wow. Wow, a claw at the end of the tail.
It might have been a nightmare, but we think we saw that in the lab the last couple of years we've been studying this.
Randy?
Well, I'll stay in the Triassic period, and probably my favorite find was something I found as an undergraduate at Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, this thing called Poposaurus, which looks like a miniature Tyrannosaurus rex walking around on two legs, has a big carnivorous skull on it, but it's actually more closely related to crocodiles than it is to dinosaurs. So there's all sorts of experimentation going on and really weird creatures back in the Triassic.
Really weird. Yes, go ahead. I didn't mean to say weird and point to you, but that's okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Why do lots of dinosaurs' names end in saurus?
Oh.
Well, part of that's tradition. So in 1842, there was a British anatomist named Richard Owen. He coined the term dinosauria. So ever since then, that's kind of been the traditional way to do it. They seem, you know, to be reptiles. Back then, they thought they were very much like lizards. So it just kind of stuck. And, you know, it sounds nice. You know, like the name Tyrannosaurus, that's one of the best names ever coined by anyone ever. So it sounds, you know, it sounds good. You know, put it after almost anything. If I could be, you know, Brianosaurus, I totally would.
Wow. I think we have one more. Yes, you have a question here?
Along with Utah's interesting geographical landscape, it has an interesting political landscape. And I know right now there is movements for federal lands to get moved into state lands and also oil industry to move in. Talk to me a bit about what your guys' impression of that. Is there concerns in that area?
Well, all of us here at the table do work on public lands. That's where we are finding our fossils because they're protected. We can get research permits, and then everything is held in the public trust in museums. And for private land, that's not necessarily the case. But we have very good laws both for state land as well as various different types of federal lands here in Utah.
Anybody want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I'm not opposed to development on private lands because sometimes we have bones exposed that way.
Yeah. Quick question up there in the balcony.
In the Jurassic Park movies, it seems as if the dinosaurs could talk to each other. If a dinosaur was of the same species, could they talk to each other?
Well, they could communicate much the way that animals do today. I mean, we can't always tell what sound a dinosaur would have made, but for a particular group, this group of so-called duck-billed or shovel-beaked dinosaurs called hadrosaurs, they have these big, funky crests on the back of their skulls, and these crests are hollow, and people have actually reconstructed what the sound was like. It's kind of like a foghorn or like a semi-horn, and these dinosaurs also had inner ears that were attuned to this kind of sound, so they're calling to each other over long distances. These are these low-frequency sounds, sort of like what elephants make today, to communicate with each other over long distances. So with those sorts of fossils, we can tell. But otherwise, it's really hard to figure out what a dinosaur would have sounded like.
Well, I want to thank you, gentlemen. We've run out of time in this segment. I had such a good time and learned a whole lot. Thank you, gentlemen, for taking time to be with us today. Randall Ermus, Curator of Paleontology, Utah Natural History Museum. Brooks Britt, Associate Professor in the Department of Geological Science at Brigham Young. And Brian Sweetek, Science Writer. His new book is My Beloved Brontosaurus on the Road with Old Bones, New Science, and Our Favorite Dinosaurs. It's a really good read, I suggest you all. Thank you. Thank you all, gentlemen, for taking time to be with us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, a couple of seconds. When we come back, we're going to take a trip to a new world, Mars. We're going to look at Mars by looking at Utah's desert. What can we learn about Mars? Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR.
Support for Science Friday comes from Carbonite, automatic and encrypted cloud backup solutions that provide access to backed up files from any device. Carbonite.com. From Zurich Insurance, sponsor of the Zurich Classic Golf Tournament in New Orleans, April 25th through April 28th. And from Sit for Less and Herman Miller, featuring the Aeron chair available online, including the True Black Color, online at sitforless.com. This is NPR.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Take a look at some of the pictures coming back from the Mars rovers. What do you see? Rocky fields, cliffs, dry ground. They look a fair amount like some of the pictures of parts of southern Utah, especially if you put on a pair of rose-colored glasses. Turns out that researchers are studying the geology of Utah to help explain some of the features that the Mars rovers and orbiters are seeing. And at the same time, other people are using Utah as a companion to Mars in another way, as a training ground to help develop tools and techniques for humans one day living and working there on the red planet. Joining me now here in the Grand Theater in Salt Lake City, from the campus of the Salt Lake Community College, are my guests, Marjorie Chan, Professor of Geology in the Department of Geology and Geophysics at the University of Utah. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
And Charles Killian, he's the CAPCOM coordinator for the Mars Society's Mars Desert Research Station that's in southern Utah near Hanksville. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah. Dr. Chan, what is it? What is it about Utah that makes a good match for studying Mars?
Utah is just a fantastic place for geologists because things are so well exposed, and we don't have a lot of vegetation, as was mentioned previously, that's covering things up. So we can make comparisons of what the surface and the landscape looks like, even from satellite types of images, and we can get on the ground and look at it in person.
Mm-hmm. How closely does what you see here track to what researchers are actually sending back from the rovers and things? Do they match up, the kinds of things?
It's been really exciting, and in part because some of the newest discoveries on Mars have found sedimentary rocks. And sedimentary rocks are the ones that contain life. And this is exciting because it really evokes the question, are we alone in the universe? And can we find potential life on another planet?
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Mars Society. What's there about Utah that makes it a good place for the Mars Society?
Well, in about the year 2000, a survey was done to find a place where one could build a habitat in an area that was a close analog to Mars. And turns out southern Utah is perfect because there's little to no vegetation and the scenery is right, which is probably because the geology is right. If I can tell just a quick anecdote.
Sure.
I was out there in October and got up early and was looking out a porthole, and the sun was coming up, and it was kind of the rosy glow you get in the desert that time of the day. And it looked just like a photograph from one of the rovers.
Wow.
It was absolutely perfect.
Wow. What sort of things are the field crews doing at the Mars Desert Research Station? What do they do out there?
Well, typically they do things like biology, geology. They work with small rovers occasionally. What they're out there to do is to develop, as you stated, tools and techniques that may be useful during the human exploration of Mars. They, for instance, might go out and bring back samples and analyze them in the lab there in the HAB for biologics, same thing with geology studies, that kind of thing.
If you have a question in here in the audience, please step up to the mics if you want to know something about the geology of Utah and the comparison to Mars. One of the things that was quite interesting, Dr. Chen, a few years ago, the Mars rover found some really spherical-looking objects. You're shaking your head, or you know what I'm going to call those blueberries. Blueberries on Mars.
Right.
Whoa. Did you figure out what they were?
Well, prior to the landing of that particular rover, I had been looking at some of these marbles, these round balls, and these are sandstones that have preferential, that have cement that are making them much harder. And
natural cement
made of iron oxides, and typically some of the minerals hematite and what we call goethite. And these are iron oxides, and this is really the history of how fluids have moved through the rock in the subsurface. And I had been studying these, and actually we had proposed an idea that this could explain some of the hematite that they were recognizing on Mars. And it wasn't soon after we had come up with this idea that the Mars rover Opportunity started sending pictures back of these spherical balls that they called blueberries. And I was one of the few people that was looking at similar types of things here on Earth. So it was really exciting because we could say there's been groundwater on Mars. And we've got all kinds of really cool balls here on Earth, and it really helps us better understand the processes on Mars.
That looks like a little flying saucer that you have.
This one does look like a flying saucer.
What is that? The same thing? Same kind of formation?
Yes, it's the same kind of cemented mineral mass that we call a concretion, but there's one layer in here in the middle that's just slightly coarser grained, and that means that it's easier for the fluids to flow along this particular band. And so it tends to stretch out that way. So you get all kinds of neat and cool shapes.
Let's go right to the questions up there in the balcony. Yes, ma'am, step
Hi,
up.
Hi, thank you.
Yes.
Such a pleasure to be here. I have a daughter who is 6 who really wants to be the first person to go to Mars. And Alice is a pretty determined little girl, but my background is in art, and so I really don't know how to steer her. So what advice would you give for a child that aspires to be a scientist in this field, and specifically to be an astronaut, possibly go to Mars someday?
I mean, that's a good question because the people who study the planets, like yourself, they're not space people. They are planetary scientists, like geologists. Because you know the planet is there, you don't have to discover it. So would you not say to her, well, if she's going to study the surface, maybe she ought to study geology?
Right. Both planetary science and geology are really important to understanding Mars. And I would say if your daughter's interested, go for it, because it is so much fun to be a scientist. You never know what you're going to find, and we could use some good scientists, people that are young and enthusiastic in the field.
Before I go to the next question, I want to ask you about something new that was just discovered a matter of weeks or months. Not the blueberries, but these little flowers. There was something like glassy flowers that started showing up on the surface. Do you know what I'm talking about?
There's all kinds of different structures that have been recognized on Mars, and some of them still are open to interpretation of what they might mean. And this is why we can use more people that are interested in using Earth analogs to better understand Mars.
Okay, let's go down here to the audience.
I know that there are a lot of precious metals in impact sites on the Earth, like platinum, that we use in a lot of industrial applications. I was wondering, what do you think the potentials for finding resources like that on Mars that might make it actually maybe economically feasible to even mine some aspects of the Martian rocks and minerals?
Yes, there have been quite a bit of interest in even trying to mine different asteroids for different materials. A lot of what's exposed on the surface of Mars seems to be similar to some of the things that we find here on Earth. There seem to be a lot of materials like basalts, some sedimentary rocks, And perhaps the asteroids are the ones that might have the greater metal potentials.
Let me ask you this question, Charles. Do your crews mimic as much wearing suits and things as they would on Mars?
Absolutely. We call that being in sim or in simulation. When they leave the HAB, they wear a Mars suit, if you will, and they lock in and lock out. We have airlocks in the HAB, and they have to spend a certain amount of time waiting to go out and to come back in. They try to do all of their work in sim, and, of course, this increases the difficulty of what they're probably trying to accomplish by an order of magnitude anyway, because they've got heavy gloves on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But again, since they're one of their objectives is to develop tools and techniques that one might be able to use on Mars, this is a valuable part of the experience.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go up to the balcony up there. Yes.
Yes, a colleague of mine, Jut Wynn, discovered a new species of troglobitic millipede over at NAU, and I was just wondering what the possibilities of discovering other troglobitic life forms on Mars are.
What is he? What is he talking about?
Well, troglobitic cave-dwelling organisms.
We don't allow jargon on this. Now we have a jargon. That's a good question.
We have all kinds of life forms here on Earth that we call extremophiles, ones that are able to withstand what we would normally think of very extreme conditions for life. And it does seem like there's possibilities that life on Mars would be the kind that could withstand some of these extreme types of conditions.
Yeah. Let's go down here. Yes, sir.
So my uncle is a soil scientist, and he knew was sent a sample of a sample from Mars. And the guy in the letter that he sent to my uncle said the word soil. And my uncle, since he's a soil scientist, got mad and sent him back that it's dirt. So what's the terminology that should be used?
Dirt or soil?
Yeah, what's the dirt on soil? Well,
I'm writing that down, Patrick.
Soil is some of the breakdown of materials under some of the surface types of conditions. And so technically we tend to use the term soils. I don't know of anybody that's really gotten any samples from Mars except for some of the meteorites that might have come from Mars.
Yeah. I think that was it.
Yeah, because we find pieces of Mars around all the time here, don't we? I mean, they come here naturally.
They're rare,
yeah.
But they are present, yes.
They are present. Well, thank you for that question. Let's go over here. Yes, sir.
Thank you. My question is for Mr. Killian. I'm curious a little bit more about what the Mars Society is doing. Are you practicing, it sounds like you're certainly practicing what you would do on Mars. Are the people there staying confined in a shelter, for example? Are you growing food within it and for some extended period of time trying to simulate what it would be like to be on Mars?
Absolutely. A typical crew rotation is about 2 weeks. And during that time, there is what we call the HAB or the habitat, and it consists of two levels. It's the lower level is labs and engineering spaces. Top side is living quarters and so on. This is where they spend actually probably 80% of their time. There is also what we call the green HAB, and this year the crews have been growing some vegetables to supplement their rations that they get when they come on site. We try to simulate as much as possible what it would be like in terms of the human interactions and the physical interactions that are required to do the kind of human exploration that the Mars Society would very much like to see happen in the not too distant future. And as a result, one of the things I didn't mention is that there have been a number of studies along human factors lines. How do people get along and so forth to do the science on Mars?
Mm-hmm. Let me go to the audience. This young... Yeah.
So I was wondering your opinion on when we go and find information on Mars, if we should send rovers or if we should physically go there and use our ideas to find information.
Robots or people?
Well, if I might, because I'm kind of passionate about
this.
Yeah,
but you are.
The rovers are fine. I think they're great for reconnaissance. But I believe that at the end of the day, it's human beings that need to go there mm-hmm. and look around and live and work. I ultimately believe that for the human race to expand its horizons is extraordinarily important.
And that's it. You're listening to Science Friday on NPR. I'm Ira Flatow here in Salt Lake City. Let's go up to the balcony one more time.
Have we ever sent any drills or spacecraft like I've seen in documentaries to the ice caps in Mars?
A good question. There was a probe that was sent to one of the polar regions, and it turned out that there was some ice damage to some of the machinery. And so there are more difficulties sending it to some of the cold areas, and many of the rovers have concentrated on some of the areas that are more in the equatorial area.
Why would you send it to the poles? What's to be learned in sending it to the poles?
You might find things out about life that can live under extreme environments there.
Right.
It's just some of the really different features that form there. There are some things that they call spiders that they think are these CO2 geysers that erupt. And they're just different things to see. It's a planet that's full of possibilities and things we still don't understand.
Do you agree with Chuck that we have to send people to Mars?
That's interesting because I'm just teaching a class called Mars for Earthlings. And probably at the beginning of the class, I thought, you know, robotic rovers are good enough. But now as I've kind of looked more about some of the advancements, we can now cut down the time possibly from 8 months to get man to Mars to some of these new fusion processes that could possibly get man to Mars in maybe 30 days or in a month. And if that can happen, it seems like these are all kinds of new possibilities for really exploring the red planet in person.
What about the scientists? There are some scientists who say that a trip to Mars is going to be one way. You've heard that.
I think it is one way.
You do, but yet the people are still lining up to go that one way trip.
Yeah, they say 40,000 people are signed up on Mars One to try to go on that one way trip to Mars.
Chuck, are these people a little?
No, they're not. Sign me up.
Sign him up. Okay.
If you look at throughout the history of the modern world, It's replete with individuals who have made that one-way trip. I mean, Utah was settled by folks that made a one-way trip. I don't think there will ever be any issue with finding people that are willing to do that. Good, solid folks that will get the job done.
Mm-hmm. I think we have time for one more question in the audience. Yes.
Curiosity, if nothing else, was a huge triumph for robotics and brought it to the public knowledge in a major way. First of all, was Utah in any way a testing ground for space exploration mechatronics? And if so, what challenges were there to overcome? And the differences, obviously, atmospheric, geologic, gravitational, things like this for robotics on Earth versus robotics on Mars?
I don't know about Curiosity specifically, but I know that robotics have been tested extensively down at MDRS in Hanksville. There are many of the same kinds of issues down there that would affect a rover on Mars, specifically that bentonite clay they've got down there. It turns into this fine dust that just screws up machinery big time. And so that's one thing they have to worry about. And just how do you power a rover and how do you communicate with it, those kinds of things.
Well, we've run out of time for this segment. I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Good luck to you. Good luck to the Mars folks. Marjorie Chan, Professor of Geology, Department of Geology and Geophysics, University of Utah. Charles Killian, he's the CAPCOM Coordinator for the Mars Society's Mars Desert Research Station. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Our program's senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our correspondent and managing editor for video. Our associate senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our assistant producer, Eli Chen. Sam Plato is our production assistant. Neil Rauch, our technical director, is at the controls here in Salt Lake, ably assisted by Manoli Weatherall back in New York. We had a lot of help today. We want to give some credit to folks who deserve it. Richard Scott, Brandon Felter, Seth Miller at the Salt Lake Community College's Grand Theater. Thank you for taking time and helping us this week. Gail Ewer, John Green, and the folks at KUER for your hospitality. We also had help today from Tinbeat Ermias of Talk of the Nation. And thank you very much for taking time to be with us today. Patrick Murray, also, thanks a lot for helping us out also, coming in from L.A. If you missed any part of the program, like to hear it again, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We also have iTunes and Android apps. You can listen on our website, as I say. You can also download our podcasts. And we're all week on Twitter at SciFry and on Facebook also. I'm Ira Flatow in Salt Lake.
Support for Science Friday comes from the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence at thescanfoundation.org. From the Langloth Foundation, supporting innovative health and mental health programs for underserved populations at langloth.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org, and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
From NPR in Salt Lake City, I'm Ira Flatow with Science Friday. I don't have to tell you that the Great Salt Lake is salty, but did you know parts of it are 10 times saltier than the ocean? This hour, we'll talk about the weird salt lovers that live there, like microbes that turn the lake red and pink, and the tiny, adorable brine shrimp. You know salt is good at preserving stuff, so scientists are searching through salty crystals for the remains of ancient life. We'll talk about what they found. Plus, Hubble's successor, the James Webb Telescope, is being built right here in town. We'll take a look at its construction and what we'll be aiming it at in the cosmos. All that and the video pic, how the local sage grouse strut their stuff in search of love. All coming up after the break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're broadcasting today from the Grand Theater at Salt Lake Community College. And of course, just up the road from Salt Lake City is the city's namesake, the Great Salt Lake. Parts of it are 10 times saltier than the ocean, but this is no Dead Sea. It's teeming with microbes which can turn the water bubblegum pink. My next guest has devoted her life to studying these tiny creatures in the water, and believe it or not, these microbes may hold the clues for better sunscreens, hydrogen fuel cells, even life on Mars. So there's a lot to talk about it. And if you ever wonder where the phrase red herring comes from, have you wondered that? Yeah. We may have a salty answer for you this afternoon. So we won't be taking any calls this hour, but if you're in the audience, as I say, welcome. You're welcome to step up to the microphone and ask your questions. Don't be shy. Bonnie Baxter is director of the Great Salt Lake Institute at Westminster College here in Salt Lake. She's also professor of biology there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira.
Let's get. Bring a fan club with you, too?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. Let's get right to the question of why for the rest of the country, everybody here knows the answer, but why is this huge salty lake here? Why is it salty? Why is it here?
Well, you know, a lot of people actually locally don't know the answer to that. I get asked that all the time. This was a giant inland sea at the end of the last ice age. It was called Lake Bonneville, and northern Utah, southern Idaho, northern Nevada was all underwater, a freshwater lake. But as the earth warmed up, ice dams broke and water evaporated, and all the water seeping out left behind this salty puddle in the bottom of the bathtub, and that's what we call Great Salt Lake.
Lovingly referred to as the bottom of the bathtub?
Yeah, it's all the debris.
It's not really one lake, is it? It's divided in half, just about.
It's divided in half since about 1959. A railroad causeway was built across the middle of it. And for most of you, if you've seen Great Salt Lake, you've probably driven by on I-80, and that's the south arm of the lake. It's just a tiny little bit you get to see. Most of the lake you can't circumnavigate by boat, and you can't drive around. It's very shallow, and it's marshy, and it's hard to get around it. So actually access to a large part of the lake is limited. So that north part has gotten super, super salty because all of the freshwater rivers flow into the south part.
Mm-hmm. How salty is super salty?
Well, the ocean is about 3.4% sodium chloride all around the Earth. And the south arm of Great Salt Lake is about 11 to 12% salt right now.
Wow.
And the north arm where I study, where I do most of my studies, is between 25 and 30% salt, so close to 10 times saltier than the ocean.
Is that dangerous? If you fell in, I mean, if something that salt, you know, we hear you the know, Dead Sea, you'd float a lot. Is it saltier than the Dead Sea?
You know, that's a good question, too, because there's something that affects how much salt can stay in water, and that's temperature. So if you want your hot chocolate powder to mix in the milk, you need to heat it up, right? So warm water will hold more salt. And so it turns out the Dead Sea is also saturated, but it gets to be more salty because it's warmer there year-round than it is in our alpine climate.
Mm-hmm. Now, you study the salt-loving microbes that live in the northern arm, the really salty part. Why are you studying them? What's there to be learned? What are they?
You know, I came out of the world of DNA damage and repair, and I was really interested in extreme organisms because I thought they might have some secrets for how to tell us how to survive damage from the sun, for example. So I went there looking for models for the laboratory, and I found this incredible environment that had never been explored. So those microbes that deal with high UV exposure, they deal with high salt, they get dried up during, you know, part of the year and live inside salt crystals. And they can deal with desiccation, be completely dried out. Those guys have some secrets to tell us. So I thought these would be great models for exploring life in extreme environments.
You mean they must have their own sunshade because they're out there in the sun? Do they?
They do. In fact, organisms that live in sunlight, microbes all around the world that live in high salt, particularly in high sunlight, will develop pigmentation. Even humans that live in high solar radiation will, have evolved with higher pigmentation. Mm-hmm. So pigments are really important for helping from sun damage and oxidative damage.
Is there a general name you use to describe what's living in there?
We call them halophiles, and halo is a root that means salt, and phile coming from love. So halophiles, they love salt.
Hmm. And how many species have you been able to find in the lake?
You know, it's up in the probably 300 to 400s by now in terms of genetically identifying organisms. So sometimes we just look for their genes. It's hard to actually make all of them grow in the laboratory. So sometimes we won't go get the cells out of the water. We'll just take their DNA and basically look at their ID at the door and try to figure out who they are.
What do they eat? I mean, in such a harsh environment, what are they living on?
They use the sunlight in part, but they're not truly photosynthetic. They really are ingesting nutrients from the water from decomposition and helping decompose the couple of invertebrates that live in the lake. It's a pretty simple ecosystem at the macro level. But the community of microbes, I think, it's a really complex community at the microbial level. So,
do they have an energy source of some kind that they're using?
You know, they are producing their own energy, sometimes from sunlight, but sometimes just from the nutrients in the lake. Well, so, yeah.
Well, a lot of questions. Let's go right to the audience here. Yes.
So I don't know if you mentioned this already, but how many chemicals are in the Great Salt Lake besides salt?
Yeah.
Oh, what an excellent question. Thank you. You know, this lake is a little different than the Dead Sea because it has, hey, come back. Don't go away. It has sodium and it has chloride ions. And the Dead Sea has a lot of things like calcium and zinc and some things different than sodium and chloride. But Salt Lake has a unique chemistry in that it has a high sulfate concentration, and that turns out to be really important too. We have a mercury contamination problem, for example, and the sulfate turns out to be important in the chemistry of that. So there are some other ions besides sodium and chloride that are in the lake. So that's an excellent question. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Let's go to this question right here.
Thank you for being here, by the way.
Yeah,
I'm just curious, were there any human beings here when Lake Bonneville existed, or was it already gone by then?
That's an excellent question, and luckily I got to be a part of the planning of the Natural History Museum of Utah. There's a great Salt Lake Gallery there, and you can visit it. And one of the most exciting things about that whole process was talking to the anthropologists and some of the other people and asking exactly that question. So Duncan Metcalf there at the University of Utah and some others who have been studying that. And they tell me the peopling of Utah happened about 13,000 years ago, and that's about when Great Salt Lake set its margins. So we think that no humans ever saw Lake Bonneville. So there would have been mastodons and giant sloths, but no people. So people have only experienced Great Salt Lake.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Interesting. Let's go up there to the balcony.
Yes, I've driven out to Lakeside a number of times, and mostly to take pictures out there. And there's a foam that forms out there if it's windy.
Yes.
In fact, it'll even form pinwheels.
Yes.
And blows along crazy stuff.
I think they look like tumbleweeds.
Is that the technical word for that, crazy stuff?
Well, it blows along. Depending on how much wind there is and how much wind there's been, it often looks like there's ice out there on the lake.
Yes.
They look like ice floes, but of course it's much too salty for that.
So
but then it does form pinwheels.
Yeah. What is he discovering out there?
So all around the world where people make salt and they concentrate salt water to make it saltier and saltier, they report this foam that appears when you get super salty water. And we see that in the north arm of the lake. So Lakeside is a point on the western side of the lake where the causeway intersects. It actually was where they set up camp to build the causeway for the railroad. And you can see the north arm and south arm from one location, which is marvelous. So what you're probably describing is a north arm activity. When we go up to the north arm where Spiral Jetty is and we are doing our studies, if it's a windy day, there'll be foam everywhere. It's like a giant bubble bath. And what we think this is, there are some very special lipids and fats that are in these particular types of cells that live in that pink water. They're called archaea as opposed to bacteria, and they have unique lipids. So we think that they're contributing their basically soap to the water, and it's causing this foam.
Wow. You can see up on our website, we have some great pictures of the Great Salt Lake, including a pelican fossilized in salt. And you go see up there at sciencefriday.com/salt if you want to go see some of these.
Thank you.
These great photos. These are key, archaea.
Archaea, uh-huh.
Archaea.
Uh-huh.
Could we use them to make fuel for us? Could we find the right kinds of things that might make biological?
Well, we've been looking in the lake for hydrogen-producing, particularly algae. Maybe even some of the archaea, because hydrogen production by microbes turns out to happen when there's low oxygen. And because it's so salty, the water cannot hold dissolved oxygen very well. So there's very little water, very little oxygen dissolved in the water. If you can think about the water molecules that would normally bind up and hold oxygen, they're engaging with salt, so they can't really hold the oxygen. And that turns out to be a place where you find unique energy metabolisms. And so we think some of these archaea and some of the algae in Great Salt Lake maybe have some secrets that could be used for biofuels.
Huh. So people are looking into that and
yes,
studying it?
Yes,
yeah?
Yes.
Yeah, because we're all looking for that kind of bacteria that could do some work for us. Making
exactly, because
yeah.
They're easy to grow in a vat, and if you could grow hydrogen, you could go to Mars.
What a tie-in. What a tie-in.
That was for you, Margie.
We're going to take a break, come back more, talk lots more with Bonnie Baxter, director of the Great Salt Lake Institute at Westminster College here in Salt Lake. Don't forget, you can come up, step up to the mic there. You could also join us talking about it at SciFry and Twitter and our Facebook pages. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about Utah's Great Salt Lake and some of the unusual life that thrives there with my guest Bonnie Baxter, director of the Great Salt Lake Institute at Westminster College here in Salt Lake. And one of the things that I was reading about in your research is that, and this is so fascinating to me, you can actually look inside ancient salt crystals to see stuff that's preserved for 100 million years?
250 million years.
250 million year stuff that living here, 250, is it still viable? Is it? Well, what do you see? Tell us what it is that we're looking at.
So I went with a collaborator, Jack Griffith, and some other folks to a salt mine that's north of Carlsbad, New Mexico. And that was a salt lake 250 million years ago, and it dried up. And it's a half mile underground, if you can believe it. And we cored salt and took it back to the laboratory. And there are fluid inclusions that form in salt, particularly when it's under pressure. And we pulled the fluid sterilely out of those fluid inclusions and did some electron microscopy on that. And we found DNA. And we found cellulose, which is, you know, what paper is made of. Cellulose on Earth, we know, is produced by things like trees, right? Plants. And some algae and cyanobacteria can produce cellulose. So there's no non-biological production of cellulose. You don't just find it in the environment. It's produced by biology. So we took some beautiful pictures of this biological molecule, and we published that in a journal called Astrobiology, because if salt can hold biological molecules for 250 million years and preserve them, maybe salt's where we should be looking on Mars for the traces of life that used to be there.
Because there was a lot of water there back then.
That's right.
And so if there was life, it would still be preserved or traces of it in the salt beds.
That would be a good
Mars.
Place to look. Are we
looking there? In those?
You know, the Meridiani Planum is an area on Mars where one of the earlier rovers was, the rover Opportunity. And so that rover discovered a salt playa that looks a lot like the Bonneville Salt Flats. We say on Earth, if you find a deposit like that of salt, you say, hey, this used to be a lake, and it dried up, and it left behind the salt. And they're actually called evaporites by geologists because the water evaporated and left behind the salt.
And so that sounds to me like it's a great place to go mining for ancient water.
Exactly. If we could teach a rover to look inside fluid inclusions.
Could we do that?
Anything is possible. Did you say the landing of curiosity?
Yeah,
anything is possible.
Anything.
Yeah.
Anything.
Yeah, that was beautiful.
Wow.
Beautiful piece of work.
Of course, other folks would say we need to send geologists there to Earth.
That's right.
Biologists themselves to look into that.
That's right.
Salt plant.
And I'm signed up for the one-way trip.
Okay. That's two this hour. Would you want to take the one-way trip? To Mars? You standing at the microphone there? Would you go? No. Well, tell us what's on your mind. Go ahead. What would you like
what's
to ask?
What's your question?
What's your question?
Is pollution affecting the Salt Lake?
Oh, that's a really good question. So there's a mercury problem. It's probably the highest mercury pollution in water in the nation. And it hasn't gotten much attention because we don't eat fish out of Great Salt Lake. Right? But the ducks are eating the brine flies, which may be bioaccumulating the mercury. So, and you know, we're on a migratory path here. Great Salt Lake is a migratory habitat for millions and millions of birds, right? So if they're going to ingest mercury, they're going to take it somewhere else. They're going to fly with it, right? So it's not just a local problem. So I've been studying the microorganisms that can change the mercury into something far more toxic and try to figure out how they're doing that. And are there microorganisms that can detoxify the mercury and make it less toxic? So there's some duck species from the lake that you shouldn't eat. We have some people at Westminster at Great Salt Lake Institute, Frank Black and some other folks who are studying the spiders of the lake because they might be eating the brine flies and then birds are eating them, and the mercury keeps getting concentrated. So mercury is one of the pollution problems that I'm actively involved in.
Hmm. That's a good question. Yeah. Let's talk about, before we run out of time, the phrase red herring.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about that.
Okay. So, you know, the idea of if you follow a red herring, you're following, you know, the wrong idea, not the main idea. And that came from dragging a herring through the woods when they were training fox hunting dogs in England. And the red herring is a salted fish. So the herring would be salted, and because of the microorganisms that turned Great Salt Lake pink, those were associated with salt that was purified from places like Great Salt Lake. And those microbes would just grow all over the salt on the fish and turn it red. And so when they drag a red herring through the woods, a really stinky, smelly, bacterial-laden fish, the dogs, they try to teach them not to follow the red herring, but instead to follow the fox trail. So those were the halophiles that
Is that right? The halophiles caused the pink
yes.
color, red herring.
Yes, yes.
Something else learned.
So see, you already knew about halophiles.
There you go. Didn't know it. It's a red herring. Let's go right here.
So I know that there was this causeway built in the Great Salt Lake, and now half of the lake is saltier. So why is that exactly?
She looks familiar.
Yeah, that's my daughter, Leela. yeah. And a shout out to the Salt Lake Arts Academy, her school. I saw some other students from
there. All right. It's good to have a lot of school kids here today.
And a shout out to the Salt Lake Center for Science Education, where my son Landis is.
There you go.
This guy's up there. Okay, Leela, I will answer your question. So there are these lakes, or these rivers that come in from the Wasatch Front into the lake, and they feed water into Great Salt Lake. And one of the things we haven't talked about is Great Salt Lake is a terminal lake, and that means there's no outlet to the ocean. So it's subject to how much precipitation we get. That lake level will change. So evaporation and precipitation are the things that control it. And water comes in from the snowmelt from everybody's ski mountains in the spring and summer into the lake in the south part of the lake, and the causeway prevents that water from flowing up to the north. So the north just gets saltier and crustier and saltier.
Wow, that's a great answer. Thank you for that question. We run out of time talking about this segment. Thank you, Dr. Bonnie Baxter.
It's sure been nice to be here.
She's director of the Salt Lake Institute at Westminster College here in Salt Lake, also professor of biology there. Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Of course, we can't talk about salt without a little reminder of how important it is to our taste buds. And producer of this segment, Christopher Intagliata, went to visit local chef Elio Scanu to get a chef's perspective on this ancient kitchen condiment.
There are thousands of salts. Maldon salt from England. Trapani salt, smoked salt, truffle salt, kosher salt, Himalayan salt, the Redmond salt. My name is Elio Scanu, executive chef for Cucina Restaurant Group here in Salt Lake City. Are there salts that are saltier than other salts? Definitely yes. For example, the Maldon salt. They are from the northern sea. They're very cold waters, but they are flaky. If you compare with, let's say, kosher salt, if you taste both, you will think at the beginning that the Maldon is saltier because you get a texture effect, but then it eases. If you put the kosher salt, you will get, you know, a very flat, salty taste. My grandmother, when she was teaching me how to cook pasta, she always said, the water needs to taste like the sea. So it gives flavor to the pasta. You just put salt and it will taste better. It's the natural flavor enhancer. In Italy, for example, when someone is not an interesting person, we say that it is like a boiled egg with no salt. È come un uovo sodo senza sale.
Up next, the Hubble Space Telescope. It has dazzled us for years with photos it beams back from space, not to mention all the scientific data. But Hubble's getting on in years. It's been up there, believe it or not, almost 23 years. When we first came on Science Friday, we're in our 22nd year. We were just starting to talk about the Hubble Space Telescope. Waiting in the wings now is the new kid on the block, the James Webb Space Telescope, that is set to launch in 2018. And the skeleton of this tennis court-sized telescope is being pieced together right now as we speak here in Utah. Think world's biggest erector set, built to survive temperatures of minus 400 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's a little bit chilly. Considering how much more advanced today's technology is, how will the James Webb improve on the Hubble? And what questions do astronomers want to solve with it? That's what we're going to be talking about now. Bob Hellickson is the ATK Program Manager for NASA's James Webb Space Telescope. ATK's aerospace group is headquartered in Magna, Utah, just west of Salt Lake. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much, Ira.
You're welcome. Stacy Palin is director of the Ott Planetarium and a professor of physics at the Weber State University in Ogden, Utah. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Dr. Palin. Let me ask you, Dr. Palin, why do we need a new telescope? What would you like to learn with the new telescope?
Well, there's sort of two things going on there. One is that, as you say, Hubble Space Telescope is aging, and telescopes don't last forever. So sooner or later, you need a new one. James Webb is optimized in the infrared instead of in the visible. And so it will be able to see things that Hubble Space Telescope was not necessarily designed as its primary mission to see. For example, James Webb is going to go after the first stars and the earliest galaxies ever to form in the universe, and it's also going to go after dusty places. So places where planets are forming, places where stars are forming, and places where stars are dying. Mm-hmm. All of that is going to be accessible with James Webb in a way that it's not with Hubble.
Could we see some of these cooler exoplanets, things like that?
And especially places where exoplanets are forming. And that might help us figure out what's going on in those very early stages when we've got lots and lots of planets roaming around inside a solar system like a giant pool table, and they're knocking each other all over the place, and maybe we can figure out a little bit more about what's going on there.
Bob, can you describe for us, give us an audible picture of what it looks like, the telescope, and how you're building it?
Yeah, certainly, Ira. The astronomers want a larger primary mirror, and that leads to better science. So the James Webb Space Telescope primary mirror is on order of about 21 feet in diameter, where the Hubble Space Telescope had about an 8-foot diameter. So we're talking about a primary mirror area that's over 700% larger than Hubble. The telescope itself does not have a barrel like Hubble did, but instead it's protected by a very large sun shield, and that sun shield is what you mentioned, about the size of a tennis court. So we have a tennis court at the base of the telescope, and then the telescope on top is more than 21 feet in diameter and leads to about a three-story telescope overall.
I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from NPR, talking about the new James Webb scope. And this has to be operated in the shadow. There is a special place found in orbit. It's like four times further away than the moon is. It's like a million miles away. But it has to be orbiting in both the shadow of the Earth and the moon at the same time.
Yeah, the right point for this telescope was the Lagrange point 2. It's about a million miles away from Earth. And that rotates around the sun with the Earth. So they try to keep it in the shadow of the Earth as much as possible. As Stacy mentioned, they're looking for basically infrared heat. So to be in the coldest part of deep space is a better location for this observatory.
So you have to keep it at like minus 400 degrees Fahrenheit.
The bottom side of that sun shield is going to be about as warm as what Hubble is, or ambient temperatures. But on the cold side, yes, it's minus 400 degrees. That's better for the science. And it's the environment that the astronomers want that telescope in.
Wow. And engineering challenges to build this thing must have been enormous.
We're building it out of graphite composite materials here at ATK. Not only were you doing the engineering, the manufacturing, as well as testing and measuring that we're going to achieve the chief requirement that ATK had, which was holding that telescope extremely steady. And the steady description of the requirement was in nanometers. We're going to hold this telescope within 38 nanometers or about 1/1000th the thickness of a human hair, while it's taking its instrument observations.
Glad you're doing it and not me. Well, let's go up to the balcony for a question. Yeah.
Thanks. How big would a telescope need to be to look at Kepler 62e and F, the exoplanets that were found last week?
So,
Dr. Palin?
It's almost not a question of how big the telescope needs to be, but whether or not it has the right equipment to block out the light from the star. So when you look at one of these objects in space, which you're often seeing together, is you're seeing the star and the planets right next to it. And in order to see only the planets all by itself, you have to be able to, in a way, slide your finger, like I'm doing right now to see you, in front of the light so that you can see the planets themselves. And so it's not a limitation of the size of the telescope necessarily, but the equipment that you have on it.
Mm-hmm. Are we going to be able to send back pretty pictures like we did on the Hubble?
Absolutely, you know, we are. Yeah, yeah.
People love that. I think that's NASA's biggest selling point of those photos coming from the Hubble.
Oh, they've been fantastic PR for astronomy. Absolutely.
But webbing in an infrared, they're not going to be the same color of pictures.
So what we do is we put different filters on that allow through light at different parts of the infrared, and then we color them red, green, and blue. So we can make those pictures every bit as lovely. And we have to color them because we're going to portray different information. We might be portraying information about different temperature ranges, or we might be portraying information about different composition areas. But those images wind up incredibly beautiful. And the reason that the Hubble Space Telescope images were so staggeringly beautiful when we saw them was because the resolution of the telescope was so high. It was giving us incredible amounts of detail. And James Webb, because it's a larger telescope, is going to give us even more detail.
Just in time for our big screen TVs to be able to see the detail on it. We're going to take a break. Everybody stay at the mics. We'll come back and take your questions. I'm talking with Bob Hellickson, who is the ATK program manager for the Webb Space Telescope, Stacy Palin, director of the Oort Planetarium Professor of Physics at DeWeber State University. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR.
Support for Science Friday comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. From the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And from the Candida Fund, supporting the National Parks Conservation Association, working to ensure that America's national parks are well-funded and well-managed. This is NPR.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the James Webb Telescope with Bob Hellickson of ATK and Stacy Palin of the Oort Planetarium, Professor of Physics at the Weber State University. We're here in Salt Lake City. A lot of people want to talk. Let's see how many we can get in. Yes, sir.
I'm wondering how you are able to focus the mirrors on these telescopes. Presumably, the material that you make them out of will contract as you get them to colder temperatures in outer space.
Okay, great question. The Hubble had a mirror that was basically glass material. The James Webb Telescope will have beryllium mirrors, and there's actually 18 segmented mirrors because it's so large to fit in the rocket. Each of these segments then have actuators behind them, so it will be able to be focused, if you will, once it reaches the Lagrange point.
And because this is so far away, it's not in low Earth orbit like the Hubble was. If there's something wrong with this telescope like there was with the Hubble, there's no repair mission.
That's correct. It's being a million miles away. The Hubble was only about 350 miles away, and we could send astronauts to that. But at a million miles away, we can't send astronauts. So it will be checked completely here on Earth down at the Houston Space Center in The Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go right to the microphone here. Oh, a little encouragement needed? No, okay. All right, next one, yes.
How are the telescopes powered?
How? Basic question. We didn't even ask the question.
Basically, all telescopes are powered with first solar array panels that recharge batteries that supply power throughout the entire telescope. So same thing with the James Webb Space Telescope. We'll use that kind of technology that has been used on satellites for a long time.
All right. So do you have another follow-up to that?
Are there any other power sources you could use if it's too far away from the sun?
That's a very good question. Let's see. We don't have a warp drive, but I think we're going to be working on that next. There are other compressed gases and things that are stored on a satellite and can be used for different types of maneuvering. But generally speaking, all of our satellites use the power from the sun to recharge batteries first.
Dr. Palin, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I'd like to jump in. So some of the rovers that we've sent to Mars have had RTGs on them, and those are radioactive thermal generators. And so just by putting a pile of a radioactive material together, it gets hot. And then you can use that energy that's coming off that material to drive a current, and then you can use it to power your electronics. So that's an option that we might have if we wanted to take telescopes and put them very
way out there. Mm-hmm. But here, you're so close to the sun, you may as well use the solar panels.
Well, yeah. If you've got it and it's free, go ahead, yeah.
I'm not arguing. Okay, yes, sir, over here. And then we'll go up there.
How much galaxies will the telescope see?
Yeah, tell us how far back. How far away? Because you go back in time, right? Further back in time you go.
Yeah, so the more distant the galaxies are, the longer it has taken for the light to get to us. And there's actually a limit to how far we can go. And that limit, the universe is about 13.8 billion years old, and we can't quite get that far. And the reason we can't quite get that far is because about 300,000 years after that, the universe became transparent for the first time. So we can see all the way back to that, it's called the last scattering surface, which is where the light that was moving around in a fog before that suddenly is free to move through the universe. And we don't quite know yet how close to that boundary the first stars and the first galaxies formed. We think it was pretty soon, but we're not quite sure exactly when. So that's part of what James Webb is trying to figure out, is exactly when did that star happen?
And so how far back, ultimate, did you think we can go?
I won't be surprised to start, so I'm trying to translate in my head in redshifts as I'm on the fly, but I think I won't be surprised to see us going back as far as maybe 12 billion years
ago. Wow. Okay. Yes, sir.
So there's all this talk about old galaxies and the beginnings of the universe, but when's anyone actually going to be looking for where the universe is expanding, the new universe?
Yeah, can you see the dark energy that's expanding? Can we see that or figure that out from the web?
Yeah, by studying these very, very old galaxies and the ones in between, we're going to really be able to nail down that acceleration curve and see how the universe is accelerating now. But if you want to see the absolutely most recent, newest part of the universe there is, absolutely right now, the latest thing, it's right here.
I got it.
That was a second ago. No. Yeah. Now newer.
Newer now. Even, now it's even newer.
Now yeah. It's newer, better. Yes. Yes, sir.
In many ways, Hubble revolutionized our understanding of astronomy and the universe. James Webb will do the same, right? So what do you anticipate as the most exciting thing to come from James Webb once it's launched?
Let's see. Let me start with, I think they went back to the Hubble with its original goals and made a comparison of what they actually came up with. And the actual inventions were so much farther beyond what they ever envisioned that we're all kind of anticipating the same sort of thing to happen with James Webb. So we're going to look back to the beginning of time, but I'm hoping the dark energy and the dark matter are what we really learn more about besides the stated goals. Now, Stacy, maybe you could add to that.
Yeah, and I would say that Every astronomer is going to have their favorite thing that they're going to learn something about from James Webb. And I, for example, love to study dying stars, and I'll find out things about that. But I think that Bob is right on, and one of the great things about these discovery machines is that you think you know what its capabilities are, and you think you know what it's going to see. But when it comes right down to it, we've never looked at the universe at this resolution in the infrared before, and we've never had this quality of data before, and we've never been able to look at this level of detail. And so I think the surprises are going to be fabulous as we start to open the window that's always been closed.
But there are some astronomers who have been critical about the infrared, that it's just an infrared telescope. And it,
yes.
Know, tell us why they're upset with that idea.
So James Webb has been billed as the replacement for Hubble, that it's going to take Hubble's place. But it's really not optimized in the optical. It does go a little way into the far red.
In other words, the visible part.
Right, but the part that you can see with your eye. And where Hubble has had such a huge impact is in bringing us these great visible images.
Right.
And so a lot of astronomers have been upset that James Webb sort of doesn't go into the visible and also has been billed as a replacement for Hubble.
So
they're upset about that, that we might be missing this. And one of the reasons for that is that once Hubble comes down, we'll be blind from space in the visible. We won't have any telescopes that even begin to compare. And one of the most valuable things you can do in astronomy is compare at different wavelengths. So compare the visible to the infrared, to the gamma ray, to the X-ray, and compare all those different pictures of the same object. And we won't be able to do that with visible.
So we need two of them.
Well, yeah.
That'd be a great thing.
We need two.
That'd be a great thing.
Right? We need another one up there.
Or two cameras on the same telescope if you're going to go to all that trouble.
Okay. Who wants to go for a two-second camera, right? Okay. Let's go. In the meantime, while we dream about that one, let's go here.
Hi, yes. I was just curious how the telescopes themselves maintain themselves in space, like if there's any kind of cleaning.
Yeah, good question. Maintenance, self-maintenance.
Oh, yeah. No,
do you get a windshield wiper on there?
Yeah. Again, it's a million miles away, and we can't really go there to service it like we did the Hubble. This telescope has a bunch of features built in, so its usable life is going to be between 5 and 10 years, and those micrometeor kinds of degradations are built into the design, so we won't need to self-maintenance it. It should be good on its own for up to 10 years at least.
When you say it's got a maintenance, so it's equipped to handle these speeding tiny meteorites that might hit it?
The design allows for that through its lifetime of about 10 years, yes.
So it might look like a little Swiss cheesy, but still work.
That's exactly right.
After a while. And when is it going to be launched, and when will it become operational?
Yeah, the NASA community is working to a launch date of 2018, and it's going to take about 6 months to get to its final position and actually cool down to the place where the temperature where the instruments can start to be used. So not too long after launch.
All right. Well, we're looking forward to it. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Bob Helixson is the ATK Program Manager for the Webb Space Telescope. And Stacey Palin, Director of the Art Planetary Professor of Physics at the Weber State University in Ogden, Utah. Up next, it's our video pick of the week. And here with me, as always, is our managing editor and correspondent for video, Flora Lichtman. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
You went on a local expedition for us, right?
I love Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
I just want to throw
They
that
love
out
you,
there.
It sounds like. Tell us about your expedition.
We went on an adventure for this week's video pick. And we went looking for a local celebrity. But I actually was hoping to fact check that with you guys, maybe via a plazometer. Who in the audience has heard of a sage grouse? So there you go. Okay, and who here has seen a sage grouse strut?
Oh.
Wow. Wow. Pretty good. But before we get more into this, I want to bring on our sage on sage grouse. Jason Robinson is the Upland Game Coordinator for the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. Thanks for joining us today and for being our tour guide for this week's video pick.
Thanks, Flora.
Describe what the strut looks like and why these birds do it.
Well, it's kind of hard to explain, but I'll do my best. Basically, a sage-grouse male has a white collar that's really bright. And what it does is they gather on these leks, and a lek is a location where males gather to kind of strut their stuff for the females, the hens. And the males dance around a little bit, all puffed up. Their tail feathers are all erect. They have very sharp, pointy tail feathers. And they have these air sacs on their chest that they fill up with air, and they rub their wings against those stiff feathers on the side and pop out and make kind of a unique noise that attracts the females and hopefully makes them successful for mating.
And I think we have a little clip of the noise of the sage grouse while it's strutting and puffing up its chest. Can we hear that?
Wow.
Whoa.
Can you do that one? Can you do that noise?
You know, I've been asked several times to do that, and I'm not able to.
This is Science Friday from NPR.
I'm Flora Lichtman.
And I'm Ira Plato here at Salt Lake City talking about the sage grouse. So you went on this expedition to look for one, right? And you found it right in the first minute you got there.
Unfortunately, no.
No.
We did not see any sage grouse, despite Jason's excellent efforts. We went all over, mountain to mountain, and we were totally unsuccessful. But our viewers... The good news is, if you go to our website, you can see them, thanks to Jason's agency, which has beautiful footage of these birds strutting around, and they do this every year at this time, right?
Right, yeah. So they go to the same locations year after year for generations, and so we keep track of that information. You know, normally on a good day, we didn't have the best weather, but usually they're pretty predictable when they're going to be there and what times and that sort of thing.
And these birds are facing some challenges here.
They are. They're actually a candidate species for listing under the Endangered Species Act. So there's a lot of conservation efforts to try and save sage grouse and keep the populations from declining.
Well, can I ask a question? I found it interesting. The video is up on our website at sciencefriday.com, and as part of the video on it, I watched your adventures. It was kind of interesting. You said that it requires a huge range of area, a lot of open space for it to be successful. Why is that? Why does it need so much territory?
Well, kind of referencing that, sage grouse are a sagebrush obligate. That means they have to have sagebrush in order to exist. But not just a few plants. They need vast landscapes of sagebrush, anywhere from 10 to hundreds of square miles. And the main reason for that is sagebrush habitats are arid. They don't get much precipitation. There's not a whole lot for them to eat, so they're adapted to eat the sagebrush. So they need these large expanses to be able to fulfill all the life requirements they have.
And they can even gain weight over the winter, you said, because they do so well.
Yeah, so they're so highly adapted to eating sagebrush, and sagebrush is actually quite nutritious, the leaves, that they can gain weight in the winter if they have enough sagebrush available.
So if the populations are declining, why can people still hunt these birds?
Well, that's actually the question I get asked most often, and it's probably one of the more controversial things surrounding sage grouse. You know, our agency's primary goal and objective is to keep sage grouse on the landscape. You know, we work very hard at doing that. One of the things to keep in mind is sage grouse are an upland game bird, so they actually produce more young than we'll be able to survive. So some of those are going to die of predation or starvation or other, you know, other factors. Here in the state of Utah, we actually harvest less than 3% of the total statewide sage grouse population. And one of the benefits that we get from that is we get a lot of data that we wouldn't get otherwise that helps us manage the species. We also have an outspoken group. Hunters are conservationists, and they're very good at conserving species and being advocates for those species. In addition to that, it also generates some funds for protection of habitat, for hiring biologists to be spokesmen for sage grouse and for conservation.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you want to see the Flora's great adventure out there, and looking for the sage grouse, it's up on our website at sciencefriday.com, and also it's very funny.
Don't miss it. These birds are really striking.
They are, and I've never seen a sage grouse before, and I was really struck by how beautiful it is and how unusual it is for Utah. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
Thank you, Jason Robinson, for being our tour guide today.
Thank you.
It's up on our website, sciencefriday.com. That's about all the time we have for today. We want to thank the folks, everybody here at Grand's Theater at Salt Lake Community College, everybody at KUER, your local public radio station, for making it possible for us to be here. Thank you. We want to thank all of you out in the audience. We have 1,200 people here. It's a great record for us to set here in Salt Lake City. Thank you all. You all deserve a round of applause for yourself for coming out to see us today. And if you missed any part of the program, if you'd like to see Flora's video pick of the week, it's up there on our website. Also, we're podcasting the show. We have a Facebook page. We tweet all the time at Science Friday. /SciFry is our handle out there. And also, you can take us along with you on your anything that you carry along on one of those electronic devices that you have. Thank you again for coming out to see us today. We'll be back in New York next week. Thanks again. I'm Ira Plato in Salt Lake City.
Support for Science Friday comes from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. From the Langloth Foundation, supporting innovative health and mental health programs for underserved populations, at langloth.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems, at skoll.org. This is NPR.